that shift happened about 8 years ago, and I think got even bigger after lockdown, where people suddenly realised that your freedom can be taken away and that your time is very valuable.
Hey everyone, I'm Katie Traxton and welcome to Anatomy of an Agency, the podcast that lifts the lid on everything that happens in the talent industry. In this episode, we spoke to Gareth A. Davies, journalist, presenter and broadcaster, best known for his work on fight and para sports. We started by asking him what he thinks of talent agents.
From personal experience, I've had a couple of publicists in my time and PR people who've worked for me and given me advice. But I've kind of fallen short every time when I've worked with a talent agent, probably because I'm not talent ultimately, but even though people have said I'm talent, it depends what kind of talent you are and maybe how young or naive or broad or huge you are in an industry where you need protecting. But my experience of agents is they are the same as anything else. They want to progress the careers of other people. They're normally people, they can come from media, they can come from PR, they can come from agency itself. And they've got an eye for talent. They've got an eye for people who are a bit different, who make noise, who people are fascinated by. And I think they just play a role, and some are brilliant and some are, you know, you could call them parasitical, I suppose, like lawyers or, you know, solicitors or accountants in the same way. But I think ultimately, if you've got a lot at stake and you don't know an industry that you're going to, into, and you're just being brought into it, or you've just become famous in it, or you're very young and you've got talent, I think they serve their purpose.
So I'm going to say, because the people listening don't necessarily know you and haven't necessarily looked up your career despite our intro, that I think you've had a fascinating, very interesting career that has fit within some traditional structures, but you've done your own way. Do you think you would be as interesting or your career would have been as interesting if you'd had an agent?
No, wouldn't have made any difference whatsoever. I think I used to be quite reluctant to do interviews and things like this and talk about myself years ago. I think given that I've been in the media and kind of fight sport industry and Paralympics sport for a long time, you know, getting on for 3.5 decades now, you know, and you know, I'm kind of an elder statesman in those things now. You get more comfortable, I think, in the role I've got in my life and where I'm used to interviewing people and actually promoting them very often. More comfortable about talking about myself and my own achievements, because I think as an artist or as a voice artist, as I do on radio or TV or as a writer, you always have a degree of imposter syndrome. And you know, when you've grown up as a journalist, I think you're at the cutting edge of describing how people are, how they're not, or what the pitfalls are, or you know, journalism is the cutting edge. I think newspapers have always been the toughest industry. Radio is more fun. TV is it's where the magic happens. I mean, I'm lucky enough over my time, I've worked on all of them and I really enjoy all of them now. Writing will always be the hardest thing. But if I'm not answering your question, I think what I'm trying to say is that I know I've worked really hard in my career and I think the rewards come, and this is what I think is very important about agency. The rewards come after years of hard work. Like, consistency over a long period of time is where I think it counts. And I think you get that from the general public who are in your industry. And it's very, very rewarding to meet people almost on a daily basis who say, I really enjoy your work. I love watching your work on YouTube. I love your radio shows. I love your podcasts. I've always read you. As opposed to the hatred and vitriol you get on social media, which is like an antidote to it. I don't know who those people are. Well, you kind of know, but you never really meet them. So you take the rough with the smooth. You know, I try not to take great things from the praise or great things from the criticism. But I think I'm pleased, in full answer to your question, that canonical ownership of your own thing, your own work, I think is really important, and that's what I would urge people to do if they're considering having an agent. I think I considered having an agent when there was this shift into social media, into about 7-8 years ago, really, into YouTube. I've got my YouTube channel, I've got my own website, I did all those things, and they're just there seeded, if you like. You know, I've got a very small YouTube following of 20,000, 150,000 on social media overall. You always wonder whether you should be growing it and whether you should have an agent for that kind of thing. But my bottom line is canonical ownership of who you are and what you do.
And do you think, because you've had a career over a number of decades, and I want to dig into a little bit more in due course of what that's involved and what you've observed, but do you think that now someone starting out, if you gave them that advice, even could achieve this canonical ownership?
Yeah, I do. I think rather like this. I'm paid to go on lots of podcasts, and we will negotiate our fee at the end of today's session. No, I do a lot of podcasts for radio and different people. I go on a lot of YouTube channels, which is why I probably, and I'm about to change that for my own. YouTube, I'm going to do more on there. I think if you were starting out now, you need your niche. Niche is what counts. Everything's in the niche. You know, I'm working with bare knuckle fighting now. You know, it was called BYB Extreme. It's now Bare Knuckle Boxing Extreme. And it's incredibly exciting organization. Very many amazing stories, and I love the backstories of people. It's one of the things that I've enjoyed most in my career is telling the backstory, the narrative of people's lives. As you know, well know through Paralympics, 8 Paralympic Games going back to 96, as well as fighters. I think they're very similar in spirit. But if I was starting out now, I would know what niche I'm in, not be random, whether it be, you know, the people out there getting millions of follows for tasting different fried chicken shops, aren't there? You know, there's a guy that does it. I remember interviewing him once at Misfits Boxing. But that niche is really important. And if you do that, you need all your social media platforms, 360, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok. I haven't got TikTok. I've kind of drawn the line at TikTok, but maybe I should have TikTok. Maybe an agent would say, no,
you'd be great on TikTok.
You should be on, yeah, exactly. That's exactly. You should be on Celebrity Get Me Out of Here. You should be on TikTok. You'd be so entertaining. Know what your line is. I think be yourself. Don't get stretched beyond yourself, especially if you're young. But do all those platforms. Create your own website. But work within who you really are. And I find that with boxers, I'm very involved in the promoting of fight sports, in the nature of what I do. 2 radio shows a week on TalkSport. Lots of interviews on YouTube channels, writing in the Telegraph, broadcasting for different people out there, on and off, that if you aren't given to smack talk on the dais at a press conference, don't do it, just be yourself. But if your opponent's into that, that's fine, just respond to it. So stretching yourself outside who you really are, what really makes you you, and what I'm talking about here is authenticity, really, is the key to it. And I think if you are going to get an agent or a representative or a publicist, have someone that really gets you. And you know that's a fact. Mm-hmm. If someone doesn't get you, they don't know when you're not an ego, when you look like an ego, or when you've got an ego the size of a small planet, and they need to calm you down. And the people I've worked with who've been very helpful to me, one of them, John Beer from Jack Taylor PR in the US years ago, and we're still friends today, and he's very successful, is he knew which TV shows to put me on in the United States. He knew when to send a limo to get me from the airport and impress me. Or he knew when to, or to get me on MSNBC to talk about the Oscar Pistorius murder trial. So I think the key is knowing someone that fits with you. It sounds really...
It's like any other relationship.
But if John Knowles' agency doesn't suit you, then make sure you know it doesn't, even though he's got some very high profile clients. I mean, I've spoken to a few people in the past. I remember speaking to Alex Segal, who's got his own kind of writings out now on being an agent and explaining it. And Alex is a great guy. And we talked about doing that at one point, but I didn't fit with them. And in the end, I realised that they didn't fit with me either. So it's a very important thing to choose, to make sure, as I say, I don't know if you agree with me, that you don't get stretched outside who you really are, especially if you're a young person and you've come off, you know, a big dating show where you're very beautiful physically and you're very young and you're not experienced yet, you might not be that educated, you really want fame, and you don't want to learn your education through the tabloid newspapers, you know? So that's what I think anyway.
I wholeheartedly agree. I mean, I think if you can't stay true to yourself and be yourself, then all of the other forces at play in an industry as powerful as the sport and entertainment one can risk tearing you apart.
And they cross over today a lot, sport and entertainment.
Absolutely.
In a very similar landscape.
Absolutely. And I also think that it's not about when you come together, talent and agent, if you aren't the right fit, it's not about one side being good, one side being bad. It's just about the right or wrong fit. But you mentioned boxing there, and you said that you've spent a lot of your career promoting boxing.
Well, I think I naturally do because I have a passion for it. So obviously I critique, but I've had this argument with many other journalists down the years that we're quasi-promoters because we're pushing a fight, we're hyping a fight, we're looking for the best story, you know, so that you naturally tend to do it.
And boxing is an unusual sport in that sense compared to lots of the others that we talk about on the podcast, Olympic sports, football, etc., because it does have a promoter, but then also the boxers have agents. Mm-hmm. Could you, for the listeners and my sake, just explain what the difference is, like what that dynamic is in that ecosystem?
Well, I think you've missed a layer there, which is a manager.
Okay.
And a trainer. So very often, in general, when someone's identified maybe as an Olympic talent from boxing, I mean, you had a very close association with a mutual friend, Anthony Ogogo.
We represent Anthony Ogogo. We love him.
Who was an absolute star at 2012. He got a bronze medal, didn't he, in the middleweight division, yep. I want to say, yeah. And I love Anthony. He's one of the great characters, one of the great personalities, beautiful human being as well, with an amazing backstory coming into the Olympics with his mother having that brain...
Aneurysm.
Mm-hmm. And him fighting through it and... being, you know, I think, is he the youngest brother of five children
and
four sisters?
He's number four.
Amazing backstory, and he's gone on to do great things in wrestling and had traumatic eye surgery, all those things. We both know his story very well, but if I take him as an example, you know, he was a very talented amateur and came through the Olympic Games in London 2012, and winning a medal of any type in your home city is a massive springboard to success. And I remember Oscar De La Hoya's Golden Boy Promotions reaching out to say, who's come through at London? And I remember saying to Richard Schaefer, their agent at the time, and the front man for them, Ogogo, can't go wrongo. Lots of rhyming slang there. But and he did get signed up with them, I believe, for a period of time. In the layers of a talented fighter, and I think even more so now coming out of the games, or someone that's rising through amateur world level very quickly, you'll get someone who might train them and then pass them on to a professional trainer when they turn pro. Mm-hmm. The professional trainer generally makes decisions. It's like a father-son, father-daughter relationship, if you look at women's boxing as well, which is obviously coming to the fore more. They generally choose or agree the opponents for their fighter with the matchmaker of the promoter they've signed with. So there's that kind of tripartite agreement. If they're very talented as well, they may have an agent, but generally they've got a manager as well who negotiates their fees for them. And
Their fees when they're fighting.
For their contract, for their fees. So you've got management, you've got trainers, you've got promoter, and then, and I'm thinking now, people like Derek Chisora, David Hay, Tony Bellew, Ricky Hatton, lawyers drop in there somewhere as well, by the way,
yeah,
who are doing their contracts for them. Once someone is earning more money, and I think this is probably true of life. Like, if you're rolling along and you're doing your podcast and it's making you millions. 40 grand, well, no, yeah. 40 grand a year, you might not need an agent to do that. But if it's making you millions, you're going to want someone to, you're going to want your lawyer for your contracts, you're going to, you know, you want your team contracted. So therefore, you probably want your agent as well at that point. Before the millions, but at some point, it's obviously prudent to have the agent. So I think when a boxer starts to get to title level and they start being paid more, maybe if they're being paid 150,000 plus for fights, 100,000 for fights, then from that stage onwards. But everybody's taking a cut, remember? Yeah. So there are complexities within it. That's why when boxers tend to get very famous and earn more, there tend to be more ructions. The ructions are always over money. And years later, people become friends again. So that those divorces are very messy, but they're almost always about money. But that's that structure within boxing. And it's quite complex.
Yeah.
And obviously, there's no book on it. There's no algorithm. The algorithm is what you make it. And I think that's true in terms of, you know, for giving advice here, if we're talking to people that are listening who are interested in either being or wanting to be with an agent, then I think that all these things hold true.
And what typically, I'm sure it varies, is the role of that agent for a boxer? Is it their commercial deals, their sponsors?
Commercial deals, sponsors, contacts with the media, promoting them, helping finesse them as different from everyone else. You've got to remember that the sports and entertainment landscape in the United States, where I work sometimes, and in the UK as well, becomes more and more crowded. It's a very crowded landscape. There's only a certain amount of space. And you know, if you've got a thoroughbred Olympian who's a rower, for example, or a canoeist, or a Paralympic cyclist who's been in the army, you know that they work on morning TV or they work on BBC mainstream because they will look to that. Whereas if it's someone that's effing and blinding and is a character, they might belong on someone's podcast, or if they believe in aliens or whatever, they might be on Joe Rogan's podcast. No, but it's about placement, isn't it?
Of course. You know? Yeah, targeting.
And you know, this is just what I've seen over all these years, really. And you know, I think again, I go back to people saying, "Oh, you'd be great on this," or "You could present this," or "You've got to be sure about whether you." There's that feeling of nerves about and excitement about wanting to do something, but there's also, I think if you look inside yourself, you know where the right fit is for you, you know? Which is why I agreed to do this today with you. Because I know, you and I knew it'd be interesting.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it's already fascinating. Do you think that in the time that you've been working in fight sports, you've seen that dynamic between the boxer or another type of fighter and their team shift at all? Because you spoke about everybody taking a cut. And historically, we've heard lots of very challenging stories across all areas of entertainment. Are people a bit more better looked after nowadays?
You know, it's really interesting because when I agreed to do this and I had a little look at the kind of concept and precepts of what you wanted to do with this, it made me think back to, for about 7 years, I was the chairman of the Telegraph School Sports Matters Awards, and we were funded by Aviva. And we had a wonderful period where we had a thing called School Sport Matters every week, and I ran that for a very long time for the Telegraph. And we had an annual School Sports Awards that we chaired with a panel, and we had winners and schools from all over the country, state school, private school. In that period, when we had our National School Sports Awards, funded under the banner of Aviva, we had them at Lord's Cricket Ground, we had them at Twickenham, we had them at Chelsea, we had them, I think, at Wimbledon 1 year, we had them at the House of Lords. They were significant events, and they drew, 15, 20 award winners from schools all over the countries. And every table I would get a sports star for, from Lee Dixon to Martin Keown. I think you know some of these guys as well, but
probably some of them, yeah.
Lee Dixon and Martin Keown, you know. And Anthony Joshua came, Gail Emms. Oh God, I can't remember all the people who came now, but I was able at that time, and I'm talking 2005 to 2012, when we won the bid to the Olympic Games itself, People didn't ask for a penny to turn up on those days. We never ever paid anyone, I'm talking about sports stars, to come to those events. Mm-hmm. Because, and I'm very proud of Anthony Joshua that he came in 2011, after he'd won a silver medal in the Olympic Games. Can't remember the girl he presented to, but she was a tiny little gymnast mm-hmm. who was about 4 foot 11, 5 foot, and there he was, 6 foot seven of him or whatever. And I remember Keith Perry, who was the former editor of The Telegraph, being there that day and saying, my word, he's going to be formidable, isn't he? And obviously he won the Olympic Games the next year and has become a household name. But my point is that for all those events, way back when, then, 12, 13 years ago, no one was looking to ask money to attend things. And I think a shift came about 2016, 2017. And I'm not dissimilar myself now. And I don't know whether it's because the world's changed and people are asking for our time, so you ask for a fee for your mm-hmm. time, or whether we were just different back then. And maybe we were different back then, and we would give of our time more for a cause. And that was a cause at the time. And the cause was making physical exercise and community and sporting activity great again in Britain, which it was all the way up to 2012 Games. And then obviously government pulled funding and all kinds of things. I don't know if you're aware of the timings and that. And we let things slip, in my view. But in terms of agency in sports and entertainment, I think that shift happened about 8 years ago, and I think got even bigger after lockdown, where people suddenly realised that your freedom can be taken away and that your time is very valuable. Mm-hmm. And I think it's accelerated now. And it's probably healthier as a result, because we do own our own time. Apart from when we're giving it for, you know, a cause, if you like. Did that answer the question?
Absolutely. And I think that's also how kind of we view the industry. As you say, you can donate your time in the same way that you might donate cash that you have.
Yeah.
But equally, people should respect that time and not take for granted that you can spend all of it showing up to places for free.
I'll tell you what I say to all boxers. When you earn money from a fight, if you've got money left over, invest it in property. That's what I always say to fighters. You know, buy a gym that's yours. Buy some rental properties that's yours. That's my agent's advice
yeah.
to them always. That if I was an agent, I'd be saying invest your money in your own thing so that you own something. And if you want other people to come in with you and invest, get businesses to come in and invest. The other thing that I didn't mention about boxers is a lot of them have sponsors as well. Mm-hmm. And I think agents help with that. But very often, I think boxers are very good at getting local sponsors as well, who want to be associated with them, because it's a very kind of community-led sport. And if someone sells 1,000 tickets, 1,500 tickets from their own community,
yeah.
their own environment, then local sponsors want to be involved with them, which makes it easier for the agent or normally the manager, whoever's helping them with that. Once you get to the stage where you're selling 5, 8, 10,000 seats, then you're big time. Then once you can take 5,000 fans with you to America, like Joe Calzaghe has done, like Frank Bruno did, like Ricky Hatton did, 25,000 fans, Lennox Lewis to America, then you've made it big time then.
Yeah. So one thing before we wrap up that I have to ask you about is, I mentioned decades of experience.
Yes, you can be my agent.
I'm doing that.
Where's
off
the contract?
Camera. We need to
where's
save the contract? We need to save the announcement.
I've been waiting for this for years.
Is you were there right at the beginning of parasport, before people even really recognised parasport. Now, I can sit here saying we represent some amazing Paralympians,
yep.
and actually there isn't always, but there might be competition to represent Paralympians. What was it like at the start?
Very similar to boxing in a way, by the way, and I'm going to talk about the Paralympics, but way back when I started covering boxing just after 1990, and I started with the Paralympics in 95, there weren't agents then, and it's very similar to growing MMA in the UK, which I was very involved with the UFC for 7 years with The Telegraph and then 5 years on BT Sport, which was what you tended to do. There were one or two pivotal figureheads at the time, Baroness Tanny Gray Thompson or Lord Holmes, Chris Holmes, a swimmer. And that they were the figureheads around the the Paralympics. So you based, they were almost like the non-agented stars of their time.
Yeah.
But the access was different. And I think it needed a sensitivity from the journalists who were covering at the time to understand that you were covering this because there was a message here that needed to get out, that it's bigger than sport, it's about society, it's about changing perception. And I remember that was a massive part of my drive, even though covering the Paralympic Games touched my soul as well, definitely touched my soul. It made you enriched as a spirit every time you went to Paralympic Games, you know, for months, because you just wanted to talk to people about the incredible things you'd witnessed, how amazing human beings can be, that it's the triumph of the human spirit, that the weakness we perceive and that we have, you can become seemingly infallible to that at times by what you can go through in life and how you can come back and recover. And I think it was very similar with boxers at the time. The access was extraordinary. My experience is, the more famous people get, the richer they get, the harder it is to get access to them.
Mm.
And the access changes. And it's not their fault. It's not their agent's fault. It's not their own agency's fault. It's just something in them and in the way they're perceived by everyone else in humankind, or fans, or whatever you want to call it, changes. And their time becomes squeezed,
mm-hmm.
but their time becomes less their own because everybody wants a bit of them for different things. And having experienced fame myself and a bit of money on just enough level that I to understand it, there is pressure on you when people feel they know you.
Yeah.
There's pressure to be, I've had days where I'm going, no, I can't do that now, I'm having a pee. Or I had it the other day, I came to this hotel lobby 20 miles from home to finish this story. Please leave me alone. I'm on a deadline. And people are very upset by that because they want a bit of your time. So the changes over time are inordinate from both fight sports and from Paralympics. And I remember when Hannah Cockcroft, the multiple
racer.
Gold medalist, started her agency. I can't remember the guy she did it with now, but they were fantastic at it. Do you remember the guy's name?
I don't know his name.
Well, they started probably after Rio, I think, something like that. Because they realised that there wasn't agency for Paralympians. If I go back to 2012, that's when it first began, Paralympians, actually. Now I remember it's coming back. From 2007 onwards to 2012, Oscar Pistorius was lionised. I remember writing pages and pages on him in the Telegraph. And that's why I was so peculiar on Valentine's Day 2013 to be covering the murder case at that point, you know, the accused murder case. But I think the projection of the Paralympic Games, when I covered my first Paralympic Games in Atlanta in 1996, the British Paralympic Team, BPA, the British Paralympic Association, were a charity at the time, and they were raising money to try and send a team. Now they're on 45 million on quadrennial funding loops now for games. That's where it changed. That's where it began, because London 2012 was the change. It's when Paralympics became commercial, and that's what we're talking about here, commercial success, realising commercial value. And they do, Paralympians now realise their commercial value to the point where, you know, as a self-entitled eight-time Paralympic coverage guy, I get a little bit snubbed when they go, oh no, they don't have any time today. I'm thinking, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm old school, please.
But the thing I find fascinating in that, just to kind of wrap up and get your view on it, is, you know, you're saying that as a journalist at the start you needed to be brought into the mission, you needed to be thinking, right, we're going to get the message out there. Well, presumably an agent would have had to have that same thought process, because the immediate opportunity to commercialize can't be seen. You need to be brought into the mission. And yet you're saying that in 2016 people like Hannah Cockcroft, who obviously is brought into the mission because she's competing, are still having to fill that gap because no agent had stepped up in the interim 20 years.
But there's a reason for that, Katie, in that Paralympics comes into focus 3 or 4 months before it happens, and then it takes over the world after the Olympic Games. And it's, for me, it's bigger than the Olympics. It's bigger than sport. And I think it just moves the needle in the world every time, you know. And you know, people like Kofi Annan, big leaders of the world have expressed, Nelson Mandela, others expressed their feelings for this as being a very special movement. And I think it's not a, like Paralympians themselves, it's one size doesn't fit all, in terms of how you can be an agent in a linear fashion in golf or in tennis or in soccer or in rugby maybe, or even in boxing. But I think the analogy with boxing and Paralympics is closer to the other sports, because you get very unusual people who come from different backgrounds and have had different things happen to them in life. The narrative is really important because they're all fighters. And I think it's sometimes, and you know, you've got to thank Channel 4 for this. You've got to thank the BBC for their coverage. I'd like to thank The Telegraph. We won 3 world awards in a row, 2004, 2008, 2012, from the Paralympic movement for our coverage of the Games. I think we got it before everyone else. And that's the point, Katie. It's the same with agents and whoever's going to work with them, anyone who chooses an agent. You've got to get it. You've got to get what it's about. And that's what I think probably being an agent is. Not that I want to be one, but that probably is the most important thing. You've got to get your subject and you've got to get what it is that you're getting across to the world, to the general public.
I couldn't agree more. And I think the talent should feel empowered to interview that agent in the same way the agent would interview them, and make sure that, in the same way when you apply for a job, you're not just the interviewee, you're also the interviewer on either side of the table.
Well, one of the best pieces of advice I ever got from Tom Farmer, who started QuickFit, I did this interview for 20 pieces of unusual business advice from the quirkiest entrepreneurs out there. One of them was Wayne Hemingway. Tom Farmer of QuickFit, who was the owner of QuickFit, told me a piece of advice that I tell to every young person and to my own children, which is, just remember, because you talked about trying to go for a job, just remember on any given day, and this is before woke and before lockdown came along, you have the right to sack your employer rather than them sack you. If you're not being treated right, you sack them and you walk out the door. And Tom Farmer said to me, that's the reason why I've got a warm room in all my QuickFits with coffee for my employees, because I don't want them to feel uncomfortable and be moaning about me making money when they're uncomfortable in their job in the winter when they're cold. I realized this straight away, that on any given day, they could all sack me and I'd have no business left. But the point is, when people are paid enough money, they will generally get someone else to do something for them rather than do it themselves. That's my experience. So as much as possible, try and do things yourself. That is just what I believe, because it's organic and it makes you authentic and it makes you grow yourself. You're not gonna dissuade me on that one, Katie.
Well, you heard it here first, guys. Gareth says you do not need an agent. Do it all yourself. Hang on a minute. Well, meanwhile, speaking of journalists, for this week's Legal Corner, brought to you by Hugh James, we decided to ask lawyer Mark Loosemore what the regulations are around fake news.
The first and most obvious potential implication is that the statement could be defamatory. So, particularly it could be libelous of somebody. So what that means is that it's untrue, that it's being shared publicly, and it's likely to cause serious harm to the person being basically written about. And so that's the sort of test for defamation or libel. There are defences to that, you know, so it's important to say that there's no defence for the fact that you've shared it and that you weren't the person who originally wrote the defamatory statement. There's no defence that you're just repeating what somebody else has written, effectively repeated it by sharing it. There may be a defence of something that's called fair comment. So if you're giving your opinion,
you say my belief is.
If you're saying that my belief is this, I think this, but you do need to be very careful, because if you're making it as what looks like a statement of fact, you are going to run into potential problems and, you know, potentially open yourself up to a legal claim for defamation. Now, obviously, a legal claim for defamation is expensive for someone to bring. It can be complicated. There can be long court battles over these things, and we've seen some of those in the media over the last few months. And I'm not going to sort of highlight specific cases, but there've been ones relating to sports and such like. But even if someone doesn't bring a claim against you for defamation, you might find that you're in breach of a sponsorship contract that you've entered into if you're a talent, you know, because you've brought your sponsor into disrepute by something that you've said. If you've made, say, you've questioned someone's integrity or stated that they, you know, can't be trusted or what have you, you know, that's potentially bringing your sponsor into disrepute. If you're an employee, you know, so you play for a team, you might find yourself subject to disciplinary action from your employer, because you know they're clamping down on that stuff now. They're monitoring what athletes are doing on social media, and you know they're taking that stuff much more seriously because it's potentially damaging their reputation and also their commercial partners. So there's other potential legal claims like harassment, you know, allegations of harassment from that sort of stuff. And so, you know, this is an area that athletes and talent generally need to tread very, very carefully. It's so easy to press that button and like, or, you know, or forward something on. And, you know, especially late in the evening or whatever, when they're relaxing and they think it's, you know, it's easy, and they're only half concentrating because they're watching the latest, White Lotus episode or something, you know, pause for breath. Put your phone down, enjoy the TV program, enjoy Netflix, and don't post on social media.
Is there a difference between, I've just made a reel on Instagram where I'm speaking to camera saying I think this is an issue, versus I've liked the fact amongst 53,000 other people someone else has said it?
Absolutely, yeah. There's a big difference. Obviously, liking something is going to be far less of an issue, but it depends on what the statement was, doesn't it? It's unlikely that you're going to be, committing defamation if you've just liked something, but you might be endangering your own reputation.
Yeah,
or dropped by a sponsor. If you've liked, say, a racist comment or something like that, you know, that could be very serious. So even liking something, you know, you need to be careful what it is.
And what about if you write in your bio on your social media, everything on this channel is my personal opinion? Are you covered?
No, in simple terms, because you may, if you're an employee, you may still be, breaching your employment contract, you know, bringing your employer into disrepute. So it's not an adequate defence. They may ask you to put that on your social media to try and distance themselves from you, but it isn't a foolproof solution by any means.
Well, I think it's time I better stop spreading rumours. Thank you to Mark Loosemore for giving me the heads up, and thank you to all of you for listening. Please do listen to more episodes of Anatomy of an Agency and get in touch. Tell us what you think. You can contact us via email at gvo@goodvibesonlytalent.com. or on all forms of social media at Good Vibes Only Talent. That's all from me for now. I look forward to speaking to you soon on the next episode of Anatomy of an Agency.